Hello, and welcome to Season 5 of Notes on Bach. This is your host, Carrie Allen Tipton, and I hope you'll join me to hear from scholars about the music, life, and historical context of J.S. Bach and his contemporaries. Notes on Bach is a production of Bach Society Houston. Learn more by visiting www.bachsocietyhouston.org. This month, we hear from Dr. David Schulenberg, professor of music history at Wagner College. He joins us to talk about his recently published biography of J.S. Bach. The book, which is called Bach, is an addition to Oxford University Press's Master Musician series. It updates and illuminates our understanding of J.S. Bach through synthesizing recent research, connecting Bach's compositions to his many professional roles, and explaining how those roles fit into broader social, family, and musical networks. In addition to discussing Dr. Schulenberg's book more generally, we'll also draw on it to give listeners some context for Bach's solo violin sonatas and partitas, which Bach Society Houston will present across a series of concerts this spring. Those concerts can be streamed online. As always, links to our guest's biography and book can be found in the show notes. David, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us this month.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be here.
Let's start out by giving listeners a broad overview of your book. First of all, can you tell us about the need for an updated Bach biography?
You know, there are so many books about Bach that another biography might not seem necessary. But this book is a life and works. It covers Bach himself as well as all his music. There aren't actually a lot of recent books of this type, especially not for general readers. My publisher, Oxford University Press, has an old book series called The Master Musicians, and they've been gradually updating it. Each book in the series is a life and works about a famous composer, but the previous Bach book in the series was published back in 1983, and its predecessor went all the way back to 1906. Views and information on Bach are constantly changing, and our ideas of what's interesting in a composer's life and works are not what they were in 1906 or even 1983. For readers today want to know something about the women in Bach's life and how he dealt with the business aspects of being a musician. People want to understand Bach and his music within the culture and society in which he lived. So there definitely is a place for a new Bach book.
How is this book structured, and why did you choose that particular structure for this particular biographical subject?
You know, Carrie, I feel very strongly that the most interesting thing in the life of a musician is his or her music. And I think this is especially true of Bach, whose life wasn't very interesting or dramatic in terms of actual events. Now, he did have a famous meeting with King Frederick the Great. And at one time, he was supposed to participate in a musical contest with a French musician who instead disappeared at the last moment. Bach also had more than his share of personal tragedy. He saw one wife die suddenly, and he buried no fewer than 10 children. But Bach is above all an iconic musician, thanks above all to his multiple roles in life, first as a music student, then a young professional organist. Eventually, he became a concertmaster, then an ensemble leader, and a municipal director of music. So I decided to alternate between strictly biographical chapters and chapters that deal with his professional roles. A chapter about his life as a young organist is followed by a chapter on what exactly an organist did in the early 18th century. Now, naturally, Bach's organ music plays a big part in that chapter. But Bach also composed some important vocal works during his early years as an organist. So that music gets taken up as well in the chapter on Bach, the organist.
Well, that sort of gives our listeners a sense of how the book is structured. And to you and to our listeners, one of the things that I found useful about the structuring of this book is that you can choose to read it from the front to the back in a linear fashion, or You can choose if you would just like to read a little bit more about a certain musical role that Bach occupied. You can flip to that chapter and treat it as a little bit of a standalone chapter. And I think that makes that useful for a number of readers. So at the end of the interview, I will ask you a bit more about the process of preparing this book. But for now, let's turn to the violin sonatas and partitas. And this way, our listeners can hear how some recurrent themes in the book connect to actual repertory that Bach Society Houston is performing this spring. So first of all, can you give us an overview of this collection of six violin pieces?
Sure. Bach's actual title for the collection is Sei Solo, that is six solos. He gave the title in Italian because the pieces are predominantly in the Italian style of the day. The individual pieces alternate between sonatas and what he called partias. Now, today we usually call these partitas, meaning suites. All six sonatas and partitas are for violin alone, without the customary accompaniment for a keyboard instrument. And of course, this makes them very handy for performance now at a time when it's so hard to get multiple musicians together in one room. Mm-hmm. So it's natural for the Bach Society to offer performances of these pieces right now. But in fact, violinists play them all the time. They're among the most challenging pieces in the standard repertoire, and most players have begun studying them by the time they enter conservatory or college. It's rare for a violinist today to play a graduation recital without including one of these pieces. Now, not every violinist plays all six, but, you know, a keyboard player like myself or a singer can spend a lifetime learning dozens of pieces or arias by Bach. But violinists have only these six sonatas and partitas, plus about 10 other sonatas and three concertos. Now, that said, the music is so rich and varied that after a lifetime of playing them, a creative musician can still discover new things in each composition.
Let's talk about the date of these works. It can be tricky to date Bach's compositions firmly due to his habit of revising and/or repurposing his music, as you often point out in the book. However, in the case of the violin sonatas and partitas, we do have a securely dated autograph, at least. And what can this source tell us, and what can it not tell us?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And dates are always a problem with any composer, but mm-hmm. especially with Bach.
Yes.
Even when we have his own manuscript for a piece. Now, practically every violinist who plays these pieces has a printed score, which is accompanied by a reproduction of Bach's manuscript. So it's one of the best known of all music manuscripts. And it's written so clearly that you can almost play from it without having to rely on a modern transcription, although there are still tiny details that an editor can clarify. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Precisely because it's such a beautifully written score, it doesn't tell us anything about how the music came into being. Mm. So, for instance, it lacks the many small corrections and revisions that Bach usually made when he was recopying older compositions. So you're absolutely right. The manuscript bears the date 1720 in Bach's own hand. But that only tells us when he decided to copy the six individual pieces into a collected manuscript. We don't know whether he had just composed the music or whether he was updating pieces that he had first drafted sometime earlier.
Well, this is a related question, just to extend that this piece of the discussion a little bit further. Did these six works have origins in an earlier period, maybe from his Weimar years? Did Bach ever substantially revise them? And can we know the answers to those?
Well, the easy answer to that, Carrie, is no. We really can't know that.
Right.
We know that most of Bach's other collections of instrumental music went through multiple versions. For instance, a year or so after he wrote out the six violin solos, Bach copied his equally famous manuscript of the Brandenburg Concertos. We know that two of these exist in earlier versions. Both of those were probably composed before 1717. That was the year Bach moved from Weimar to Köthen. Mm-hmm. We also know that Bach later borrowed several movements from the Brandenburg Concertos. He inserted them into cantatas that he performed after 1723 in Leipzig. In the case of the six violin solos, however, we have almost no evidence for any versions other than those in the 1720 manuscript. Bach must have revised them in the same ways he did other music, but when and how, we simply can't say.
So often the case with Bach, as we'll hear more about as we move through this discussion. Give us some broader biographical or professional context for Bach in 1720.
Okay, well, there's a lot. The year 1720 falls right in the middle of Bach's time at Curtin, which lasted from late 1717 to spring 1723. Now, Bach came to Curtin from Weimar, and there he probably wrote his other famous pieces for unaccompanied string instrument. Those would be the six suites for solo cello. Those were almost certainly written before the violin solos. But again, we have no specific information about when they were composed or for whom. We do know, however, that Bach almost never wrote music that was not for some immediate purpose. So we can guess that both the cello suites and the violin solos were written for performance either at Weimar or at Curtin. We know that Bach knew several capable violinists. Mm-hmm. Among them was the composer Johann Georg Piesendell, who also wrote solo violin music. Piesendell probably visited Weimar in 1709. But Bach's violin pieces seem more mature in style than anything he might have written up to that point. There were good local violinists at Weimar and also at Curtin, and Bach probably composed the music for one of them. The most likely is Johann Spies, who had come to Curtin from Berlin. And at Berlin, Spies must have played Corelli's famous Opus 5 violin sonatas. They had been dedicated to the Queen of Prussia. Now, at Curtin, Bach served as Kapellmeister for the ruler, who was Prince Leopold. This meant that Bach was the chief musician for the entire principality. Now, Prince Leopold was a Calvinist. He was a member of the Reformed denomination. Mm-hmm. Calvinists were not supposed to indulge in elaborate church music. That was for Lutherans and Catholics. But we don't know how strict Prince Leopold was. And it's possible that Bach did play on the organ in the prince's chapel during services. There was an organ there. But the only vocal music that Bach is known to have composed at Curtin are a few works that were written for the prince's birthday and for New Year's celebrations. Now, this is why it's always been assumed that Bach focused on instrumental music during this period. He also did a lot of traveling. He visited other courts in the region, and he probably served as a sort of musical diplomat. He would, we assume, perform for the prince's allies, and he would report back on conditions at rival towns. Now, by the way, the year of the violin solos, 1720, that was also the year in which Bach gave another famous manuscript to his oldest son, Wilhelm Friedemann. Wilhelm Friedemann's music book contains the keyboard pieces known as the Inventions, which piano students still play. Now, also in 1720, unfortunately, Bach lost his first wife, Maria Barbara. She died suddenly while he was away on one of those trips. But it was probably through his travels during the following year that Bach met his future second wife, Anna Magdalena. Members of her family worked as musicians at several courts. And even before their marriage, she was singing in performances at Curtin. Now, Prince Leopold himself was an accomplished amateur musician, like King Louis XIII in 17th century France, and the later King Frederick the Great of Prussia. The fact that the Prince of Curtin could play violin and viola da gamba suggests that he would have taken an interest in unaccompanied pieces for his musicians. It's unlikely that Leopold himself could play Bach's violin pieces, but the two must have performed together in private concerts with the court ensemble.
And we'll come back a bit later to the idea of what purpose these particular pieces may have been written for, and again, whether or not we could know that. Let's think here about how these particular violin pieces relate to existing models. And I think that's something that in general is an interesting thing for us to think about, is how does box music expand on or extend existing forms and idioms? Because he oftentimes is not just creating things out of whole cloth. Tell us about this.
You're absolutely right. Bach was constantly using older models, and he had a lot of models available to him because mm-hmm. he was a music collector. Even though he lived in a relatively isolated part of Europe, he knew music from all over, mm-hmm. and he studied it. He incorporated ideas from all sorts of music into his own music. Now, German-speaking violinists had been writing unaccompanied solos for their instrument since at least the mid-17th century, 60 or 70 years before Bach wrote his pieces. Bach must have known one set of pieces, which was published in 1696 by Johann Paul Westhoff. Now, shortly after he published those pieces, Westhoff went off to work for the Dukes of Weimar. And Bach would have met Westhoff when he first went to Weimar in 1703. Now, Westhoff's violin solos take the form of six suites. They resemble suites for harpsichord that were composed by Froberger earlier in the 17th century. And these suites consist of stylized dance movements. And each piece in these suites is a type of dance or type of dance music for a dance that actually was danced at the French court and on stage. Now, Bach's three violin suites or partitas alternate with sonatas. Unlike the suite, which was French, the sonata was an Italian genre. And Bach's sonatas for violin were based above all on those of Corelli, who I mentioned previously. Mm-hmm. But even Bach's partitas are fundamentally Italian in style. And the idea of alternating between two different types of pieces, that is, sonatas and partitas, that also came from Italy. In 1700, the Venetian composer Albinoni had issued a collection consisting of concertos alternating with sonatas. And Bach knew at least one of Albinoni's concertos. We know that because we have a manuscript copy that Bach made of one of those pieces during his Weimar years. By the way, Carrie, while we're on the subject, if I could say a little more about the French dances, especially the chaconne.
Yes.
Bach's second violin partita begins with the four traditional dances of a French keyboard suite. These are the same four dances that Westhoff wrote for, in his violin solos. There's an allemande, then a courant, a saraband, and a jig. Now, with these four movements, Bach demonstrated that an unaccompanied violinist could play the equivalent of anything that a harpsichordist could do. And he also demonstrated that he could do what Westhoff had done previously for unaccompanied violin. But then Bach adds an enormous chaconne as the final fifth movement. And Bach had never written anything comparable for harpsichord. The only thing that approaches the violin chaconne in form and dimensions is Bach's Passacaglia for organ. Mm-hmm. So he's going beyond everything, even anything he had done
yes.
in this piece. Now, Bach's chaconne is the most famous movement of all the violin pieces. And for players today, it's wrapped up in all sorts of myth and mystique. But for Bach, it was just another French dance, although mm-hmm. a very special one. French Baroque operas and ballets typically included a chaconne as something like a grand finale. And these chaconnes incorporate dancing as well as singing. And there are magnificent examples in the stage works of Lully and Rameau. Now, Bach knew this tradition. And when we hear the violin chaconne, we should remember that any listener at the time would have connected it with the great French Baroque ballets and operas. Now, a chaconne consists of many variations on the same short harmonic pattern. And I'd like for us to hear the opening of the piece. Since I'm a harpsichordist and not a violinist, here's my own version for harpsichord. Thank you. That's how Bach's Chaconne begins. The piece consists of 64 variations on a four-bar phrase. You just heard the first two variations. The steady repetition of this basic pattern, together with continuous variation, gives any good chaconne a mesmerizing quality. Hmm. But Bach goes beyond that, and he shapes the piece by making the variations wax and wane in intensity. So here, for instance, are two very lively variations, and these occur about 2 minutes into the piece. So exactly halfway through the chaconne, Bach returns to the opening and repeats the first two variations. But then he surprises us. The music suddenly grows softer, yet brighter, as he shifts from the minor mode to the major mode. Here's how this new section sounds. So from this low point of intensity, the music gradually picks up again, and eventually it reverts to the minor mode, ending just as it began. Now, this idea of switching between major and minor modes came from the French composer Lully. It's one of the many musical ideas that Bach adopted from models by other composers. But of course, Bach goes far beyond his models. Just in terms of sheer length, each movement in his violin solos is a bigger composition than any individual piece by Westhoff, Corelli, or even Lully. Although they're written for a single violin, each is as long and as ambitious as Bach's grandest organ pieces. These violin solos are also more complex than anything comparable by earlier composers. They hint at the same types of advanced counterpoint and harmony that we hear in Bach's music for keyboard instruments and for musical ensembles. Like those works, they also contain melodic decoration of a type that other composers left up to the performer to improvise. For instance, Corelli's sonatas include some very simple slow movements, but Corelli expected violinists to add elaborate embellishments whenever these movements were played. Each of Bach's three sonatas opens with a slow movement, but Bach writes out the melodic decoration, and we'll hear some of that a bit later. Mm-hmm. The movement that follows is a fugue, and Bach's fugues naturally are far longer and more sophisticated than the fugal movements in Westhoff's suites or in Corelli's sonatas.
Well, that gives our listeners some wonderful detail that they can be listening for when Bach Society Houston streams all of these works across the spring. Let's talk now about how these works were organized. The book discusses Bach's habit of creating collections of 6 or sometimes 12 pieces. Sometimes there was a larger musical concept structuring the collection. And before I ask you my questions, I just want to give a sidebar to our audience. I think our longtime listeners really have absorbed this by now, but behind each of these seemingly simple questions lies a vast historiography. And sometimes that historiography has been marked by really some lively debates around some of the issues that we're discussing. And these questions are no different. Where does the idea of or creating collections, especially in numbers of 6 or 12, come from? And does a larger musical principle or concept order the collection of solo violin works that Bach has for us?
That's an interesting question because, you know, I think ultimately human beings like to put things in order.
Yes.
We see pebbles on the floor and we put them in rows
and so forth.
Musicians had been publishing ordered sets of compositions since the 16th century. In other words, almost since the beginning of music publishing. Mm-hmm. Bach didn't actually publish the violin pieces, but he must have modeled the set on collections like Corelli's sonatas, which did come out in a printed edition that was an edition of 12 pieces. Half of those sonatas, the first 6, were so-called church sonatas, which included fugues like Bach's sonatas. The second half dozen of Corelli's sonatas were chamber sonatas, and these contained dances like Bach's partitas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that the idea of combining pieces in dozens or half dozens was important to Bach and his contemporaries. It's what they did. Bach's three collections of harpsichord suites each comprise six works. There are six Brandenburg concertos, six organ sonatas, and six sonatas for violin with harpsichord. There are four times six, or 24, preludes and fugues in each book of the Well-Tempered Clavier. Usually the pieces are all in different keys, and that's the case with the violin solos. The different pieces within a set repeat certain types of movements. So as we've seen, all three violin sonatas open with a slow movement followed by a fugue.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's variety as well, because the three fugues have three very different themes and rhythms. Now, you mentioned controversy. It's been proposed that Bach's collections were also based on a much more complicated numerical system.
Mm-hmm.
This theory is not universally accepted, but I think it does deserve serious consideration. The British and Swedish musicologist Ruth Tatlow has found that the six violin solos contain exactly 2,400 measures. That's 2,400 bars. Other Bach collections contain similar round number quantities of music. Tatlow also finds interesting proportional relationships between pieces within collections. Now, it's possible that some of these numerical relationships that Tatlow discovers, it's possible they arise through sheer coincidence. Still, it's a serious theory. And unlike other theories about Bach and numbers, Tatlow's theory doesn't make any claims for the symbolic or mystical significance of the numbers. But her theory does suggest that Bach designed his violin solos just as an architect or an instrument maker would have worked, following a numerical or a geometrical plan that isn't obvious to the casual observer.
And just a side note to our listeners, you can hear more about Ruth's theories and her research into this by going back to season one of Notes on Bach. She was our January 2017 guest. That should be episode 4 back in our archives if listeners are interested in consulting that. Let's talk about sort of, in a way, how these pieces sound to modern listeners in terms of whether they are challenging for the player, perhaps even challenging for the listeners, and would that have been true in Bach's own time? Your book touches on how expectations for instrumental performance changed during Bach's lifetime, trending more or less towards the virtuosic and idiomatic. Would these pieces have been considered demanding to play in 1720?
Oh, yes, by all means. Mm. In his organ music, which Bach wrote for himself to play, he pushed the boundaries of what seemed humanly possible. And here he does the same for the violin. Now, Westhoff's violin pieces, as well as some earlier German violin solos, are far less demanding. And the demands, by the way, are not merely technical.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard enough just to find all the notes on the instrument and play them in time and in tune.
Yes.
But the player also has to project a coherent melodic line, as well as the implied bass or accompaniment. Someone who's unfamiliar with Bach's other music will have a tough time understanding these pieces. That's probably one reason that they don't seem to have circulated very widely during his lifetime.
Mm.
In 1720, only one or two of Bach's early vocal works had appeared in print. Some of his keyboard music was becoming known through manuscript copies, but few string players of the time could have known Bach's violin solos. Now, they would have known challenging music by earlier composers, such as Corelli or the Austrian violinist Heinrich Bieber. These had been published, and they're comparable to Bach's violin solos in some ways. It's also possible that Pisendel and other contemporaries were writing and playing difficult solo pieces that don't survive. But the trend during Bach's lifetime was away from the particular types of challenges that his music poses. Younger contemporaries like Leclerc in France and Johann Gottlieb Graun in Germany were extending the technique of the violin. But they didn't write the types of contrapuntal and harmonic complications that Bach did, nor did they compose violin music without accompaniment.
You know, the discussion of the difficulties of performing these pieces kind of raises the question whether Bach himself would have been able to play these. His keyboard works, for example, give us some window into the kind of keyboardist that he himself may have been. Do these six works tell us anything about Bach as a violinist?
You know, Carrie, I think you're right about the keyboard music, but I honestly don't think we learn much about Bach, the violinist, from these pieces. He certainly could play the violin.
Sure.
And we're told that he could lead an ensemble while doing so. There's another report that says he enjoyed playing the viola because he liked being in the middle of the harmony. Well, when I was in high school, I liked playing the viola for the same reason, but also because viola parts tend to be easier than violin parts.
Right.
So Bach probably was no violin soloist. Rather, he was good enough as a violinist to understand how he could push the envelope without asking for the impossible.
Let's come back to an idea that we have touched on a little bit earlier. Your book brings up several times the disconnect between what Bach was known for in his own time versus what he is known for now. These six works, I think, are a good example of this disjunct. As you mentioned earlier, they are now a cornerstone of the violin repertory. But is there any evidence that they were published or circulated in manuscript form or otherwise performed in Bach's own time?
Well, I've already mentioned that Bach's violin solos don't seem to have circulated. Now, during the later 1720s, Anna Magdalena Bach did make a manuscript copy of the pieces for a violinist named Schwanenberg. And Schwanenberg at the time was studying with Bach in Leipzig, probably studying composition, not violin, obviously.
Right.
Schwanenberg probably took the music back home to where he worked, which was in Brunswick or Braunschweig in northeast Germany. But that copy is the only evidence we have for contemporary transmission of the pieces to a string player. Two other early copies were made by organists. Bach himself is reported to have played the pieces on the clavichord, which was a type of keyboard instrument. And in fact, one of his organ students made a manuscript copy of selections from the violin sonatas arranged for keyboard. And actually, I'd like to use one of those selections to demonstrate what an actual 18th century arrangement of Bach's violin solos sounded like. This is the opening adagio from the second sonata. The arrangement is probably Bach's own. It's thoroughly idiomatic to the harpsichord, yet it's also very faithful to the original violin piece, which in turn echoes the ornamented adagio movements of the Italian tradition. That arrangement for harpsichord of one of Bach's violin solos might be the way you were most likely to hear them during his lifetime.
Interesting.
We start to see manuscript copies of the original violin versions during the second half of the 18th century, after Bach's death. In 1802, the first complete edition was printed. Yet the pieces were already mentioned in Bach's obituary and in a book published in 1758. So even if they weren't often being played in their original version, before the end of the 18th century, they must have become legendary for the challenges that they pose for violinists.
A major through line in your book is the idea that Bach often synthesized archaic and innovative musical styles, or styles that would have been innovative in his own time, of course. Do we see that in these pieces?
You know, Bach, I don't think Bach saw himself as an innovator. His innovations are more in the way that he He mixed ideas from his contemporaries and then developed them at greater length and extent than anybody else. Hmm. His contemporaries, on the other hand, considered any evidence of counterpoint in a piece to be a sign that it was old-fashioned. Hmm. So the mere presence of fugues in the three sonatas would have seemed archaic to Bach's contemporaries. And yet only one of those fugues hints at what was then called the stile antico, the older style. Mm-hmm. And that's the fugue from the third sonata. This fugue is an immense example of what the British Bach scholar Peter Williams called demonstration counterpoint. And a composition of this type takes an old-fashioned theme or subject and develops it through various traditional devices, including those which musicians call inversion and stretto. Now, Bach included demonstration counterpoint in several of the great organ fugues composed previously at Weimar. There's also demonstration counterpoint in the well-tempered clavier, whose first book was completed around the same time as the violin solos. And all of these examples of demonstration counterpoint were drawing on traditional, even archaic musical techniques. And yet most of those same fugues, including the one in the third violin sonata, also incorporate episodes in the style of an up-to-date Italian concerto. Mm. So I think that on the whole, Bach must have intended these pieces to be very much in the current French and Italian styles. There are echoes of older music, especially Corelli's, but even Corelli's violin sonatas were only 20 years old when Bach right. wrote out his manuscript of the violin solo. So I think as far as Bach was concerned, this was still contemporary music.
Right.
And he was writing in a contemporary style.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you. That is a wonderful sort of bird's eye view of some of these pieces that Bach Society Houston audience members will get to possibly hear in person in a limited capacity in Houston, but certainly anyone around the world can tune in over the next few months as they are released via streaming. So let's kind of pan back out and talk a little bit about the process of writing the book. I think our listeners enjoy getting an inside view of what a scholar does, especially what a musicologist does. Sometimes that's a bit of a mystery. So let's go back to a panoramic view and get your reflections on the process of writing and researching this book. First of all, and these are questions that I ask almost every guest who comes on the show who has a recent book, what were some challenges in this project?
Well, you know, Carrie, I've been playing and studying Bach's music and reading about his music and his biography for most of my life. Mm. But so much has been said and so much has been written about him that it's an enormous challenge to write a biography and feel that you haven't missed something. Mm. There are aspects of Bach scholarship that I never previously explored, but now I had to dive into them. For instance, any biographer has to say something about the enormous Bach family,
yes,
including his older relatives and the families of his wives. And some of my reading on these subjects had to be in old Nazi-era publications from the 1930s. Hmm. Slogging through these could be an unpleasant chore, but that was when German scholars were really interested in, you know, the family.
The German family,
Bach.
Right. Right.
And how Bach arose.
Right.
Now, more modern approaches to history and biography focus on culture. They focus on family life as a part of society. Mm-hmm. They focus on economic structures and other interdisciplinary subjects. But most of what historians have written along these lines is not about the provincial parts of Germany where Bach spent his life. So I've tried to extend these lines of thinking to Bach. For instance, when I discuss his employment conditions and his relationships with court and city officials. Now that can take us rather far from the music. So another challenge was to see whether these mundane issues shed any light on his composing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that there's a direct link, but throughout his life, Bach was striving for equal status with government officials, church ministers, and other educated members of the upper middle class. That might be one reason why his Weimar cantatas sometimes go out of their way to set their texts in a highly rhetorical manner or to incorporate church hymns in clever ways.
Well, I really appreciated your focus on situating Bach within contemporary human and social networks, ranging from sort of the more micro networks of the family out into some of the bureaucracy that he was a part of. And I think this is a trend in more recent Bach studies to do this. But I think that's really helpful because in popular thinking and popular writing, oftentimes, as you know, Bach is treated like a figure that is somehow outside of time or before his own time. And so I think your book is really helpful in that regard. So when dealing with Bach, and this is another one of these questions that we could spend hours on, there are many points where scholars must or should be content to say, we just don't have enough information to know whatever the topic is at hand. Can you tell us a bit about how you handled this uncertainty in your book research?
Well, I've already mentioned the difficulty of understanding when or for what purposes Bach wrote much of his music. This is part of the larger problem of relating the events of his life to individual compositions. Mm-hmm. Only some of the cantatas and a few late instrumental pieces can be precisely dated. And these are all mature works composed long after Bach was a fully formed musician. Yet we want to know, how is it possible that an orphan born in a not particularly well-off or well-connected part of Europe could have become perhaps the most cosmopolitan composer and greatest performing musician ever? Now, with composers like Mozart and Beethoven, we have all sorts of contemporary documents about their training, personality, relationships, not to mention details about the circumstances of particular compositions. Now, we can't explain the mystery of creativity, but for Mozart or Beethoven, we can trace its development and we can see when and where certain sparks appeared. We really can't do that for Bach, although I've tried to show how certain aspects of the towns in which he lived, the people and music with which he came into contact, and his travels all made their mark on him. Bach had strong ideas that sometimes got him into trouble, but he also seems to have been able to transform himself in order to make the best of any circumstance. For instance, just before the end of his time at Weimar, he somehow angered the Duke and he was thrown into prison. Bach had gone to Weimar thinking that there he could realize his goal of composing and performing first-rate sacred vocal music. Now, as soon as he was released and safely ensconced at Curtin, he turned to writing instrumental music and the occasional secular cantata. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that later at Leipzig, something similar happened. His superiors at the St. Thomas School and on the city council began giving him a hard time. So he again gave up writing church music, turning instead to secular cantatas and concertos for performance at a local coffee house. We don't know his precise motives, but the pattern becomes clear when you see Bach in the context of his society, which was modernizing in certain ways, yet it was still a rigid theocracy in others.
Related to that, are there specific sources or types of information about Bach's life or his works that you particularly wish had survived?
Well, we all wish we had a time machine that could take us back to 18th century Curtin or Leipzig and see exactly how Bach directed a performance, played the organ, or taught. You look at that well-known portrait done late in Bach's life by Hausmann, and you see a person who is obviously intelligent, intellectually lively, but not very forthcoming. Mm. The painting gives you no clue whether Bach had a sense of humor, whether he enjoyed the everyday things in life, although we know from other evidence that he did.
Yes.
I mean, of course, we'd like to know all sorts of things, not only about Bach as a person, but about his music and his choices as a composer. Every scholar would like to know exactly when and where certain pieces were written, especially the early ones. We'd like to know whether Bach really composed 100 or more sacred cantatas that seem to be mentioned in a contemporary document, but which they've never been found.
Right.
I personally wish that more of the secular cantatas had survived.
Yeah.
But I'd also like to know how he expected violinists to play the chords in the chaconne,
right,
or his tempo and registrations for the organ passacaglia. I'd like to know whether he really left Curtin for Leipzig because he was devoted to church music, or was it just because he thought he could make more money there and send his boys to college? So you know, we're stuck with what we have. Above all, Bach's compositions. If we had more information, we'd still need to devote most of our efforts to discovering fresh things in his music. And performers do that all the time. Bach was endlessly inventive, and the music is endlessly challenging to listeners as well as performers. We don't need anything more. Anything else is just icing on the cake.
Did anything surprise you as you worked on this project? Did the project reframe your understanding of Bach in any significant way after a lifetime of study, as you've already mentioned?
Definitely, Carrie. Here's a couple of examples. During the earlier 20th century, Bach was often referred to as the fifth evangelist. And of course, this was in view of his many sacred compositions.
Sure.
Then it became fashionable to de-emphasize the religious element in his life and works. And I have to admit that until I began writing the book, I wasn't interested in theories about Bach and religion or about religious messages in his music. But you just can't write an accurate and complete biography of Bach without considering the place of religious belief and worship in his society. Bach apparently saw himself as the equal of the pastors with whom he worked, even though he lacked their educational credentials. He seems to have been motivated by strong religious commitment. But this, together with what looks like great self-righteousness, immense self-confidence, and a rather reactionary worldview, all of this could have produced what many people today would see as a rather unattractive personality. Now, this interpretation of Bach probably isn't relevant to his music, but it does change the way we think of him, and it makes him a little less of the iconic or ideal musician that some imagine him to have been. Now, a related aspect of Bach that I really hadn't thought about until I was finishing the book is that he lived in a time and place where social inequality was pervasive and accepted. Until he was almost 40, his choices as both a person and an artist were shaped entirely by his subservience to monarchs and aristocrats. Like nearly everyone at the time, he accepted this state of things as normal and divinely ordained. Now, his fellow German composer Telemann did write that life was better in what he called a republic. Now, by republic, Telemann meant life in a city. But cities in Bach's day were oligarchies.
Right.
Bach followed Telemann's advice when he went to Leipzig. And there he worked not for a duke or king. He worked for the city council. But the council was elected by and made up of only the wealthiest and most powerful lawyers and businessmen in the city. And there Bach was also subject to the local church administration, which was controlled by the ruling Duke of Saxony. Now, we might see some of Bach's music as an expression of creative independence from that authority. His Leipzig cantatas, they couldn't have pleased everyone who heard them.
Right.
But when his superiors failed to defer to him on the evaluation of students or on the place of music at church and school, Bach responded passive-aggressively. He refused to compose or perform as he was expected to do. In later years, he focused on polishing his final compositions. And it's possible, I think, that his focus on abstract counterpoint and keyboard music during his final years was an expression of independence from the strictures of a repressive society, although I don't think Bach would have understood it in that way.
Sure. Interesting. You know, I'm going to make another sidebar to our listeners who might be interested, since Schulenburg has referenced this a couple of times, who might be interested in learning a bit more about some of the conflicts that Bach had, especially in Leipzig. I would recommend that you go back to my interview, I'm going to anglicize the scholar's name, with Michael Mall from a couple of years ago, who has written a history of the St. Thomas School and Choir that spans literally almost a millennium. And he talks in depth about Bach's issues that he had with especially with the city council in Leipzig. And it just will illuminate, I think, some of what our guest today is talking about. So just a sidebar to listeners there. Yeah, did you want to add something?
No, go ahead, please.
Oh, well, I was just going to move on to the next question, but I would love for you to add more on this topic if you want to.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Michael Mal, because he actually caused me a little bit of a problem, but it was a useful problem. Just as I was finishing my book, he came out with a big, thick, fact-full book about not just Bach, but the Bach choir.
Right.
And the choir at Leipzig.
Right.
And I had to go through that naturally. And,
right.
And put in information into my book, which Michael had unearthed.
Yeah, you know, it's a great problem to have as a scholar, but can also be really stressful. I'm also in the middle of preparing a book manuscript. And boy, people just keep publishing new and relevant things all the time. That you've got
especially
to continue to engage with. Yeah, right. And that's something that I want listeners to really take away from the show, though, is that even historiography around a figure as far away as Bach, historically speaking, it's lively and it's robust and it evolves. And people take up different questions according to where we are socially, and different generations of scholars adopt different perspectives. And I really want people to understand that the musicological enterprise is not static around Bach. So I'm glad you said that. What do you hope that readers take from your work, especially non-specialists who pick up this biography? And I think this is obviously a great fit for non-specialists. What do you want them to get from this book?
Well, you know, Carrie, we've just been talking about how there's this enormous amount of information out there about Bach and his music. Just sorting it out can take a lifetime.
Yeah.
So I wanted to help readers with that. I mean, most of you who are listening, you do not have time to go to the library and read obscure German language publications about Bach. And yet you might be curious about, you know, where did his wives come from?
Right.
What did a town musician do in 18th century Leipzig? So I wanted to help readers see Bach as a real person, engaging with other people as he negotiates the complicated politics of the Weimar court, or as he organizes performances of both sacred and secular cantatas for both church and coffee house at Leipzig. I think that when we see Bach this way, it does take away the halo that often surrounds him, but it also lets us hear his music on its own terms and not as the expression of some romantic mythology. Mm. Bach was very much a person of his time and place, not a saint, not timeless, as you put it. But precisely for this reason, Bach is also a person that anybody today can relate to, even as he was also a genius of unimaginable creative power.
Well, finally, to wrap up, tell us what is next for you.
Oh, thanks for asking. There's a much longer version of my Bach book, and it's meant for those who get through this one and want more. This longer version goes into greater detail on various problems in his biography, as well as the analysis of his music. And I hope to bring this out within a few years.
Oh, fantastic.
Right now, I'm working on a book about historical performance. And I've taught Baroque performance practice at a number of places, including Juilliard and Boston University. And so I'm putting into this book what I've done in the classroom. It's probably going to be a book more for musicians than either musicologists or general readers. So it'll be a different thing from the Bach book.
Sure.
On the performance side, as you know, Carrie, I'm preparing an online video presentation for the American Bach Society in April on Bach's music for flute and harpsichord. In May, I've got a CD coming out that I recorded two summers ago with a violinist named Augusta McKay Lodge.
Oh, great.
And two other superb string players. And this CD is going to feature some amazing music for violin, viola, and cello, mostly by Johann Gottlieb Graun. I mentioned Graun earlier. Graun taught Bach's son Wilhelm Friedemann. And he later worked at Berlin along with another Bach son, Carl Philipp Emanuel. And in fact, we planned this CD to include a trio sonata that was probably composed jointly by C.P.E. Bach with his father. Then we found we couldn't fit it onto the CD. So I've put that trio sonata on my website, where you and your listeners can also find many other writings and recordings, including lots of more Bach.
Well, that's wonderful, David. Thank you. And for our listeners, as always, I will put the links that David has mentioned in the show notes so that you will be able to go directly to his website and listen to that trio sonata. That sounds really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us this month. This has been a real pleasure, David.
Well, thank you, Carrie. It's been wonderful. And I'm looking forward to hearing those performances by members of the Houston Bach Society.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for this month's episode of Notes on Bach. For more about the show or about Bach Society Houston, please visit www.bachsocietyhouston.org or email me at notesonbach@gmail.com. That's notesonbach@gmail.com. Thanks and see you next time.